So 84,000, the group that is involved in translating all the sutras into English, is releasing on the anniversary of the first turning of the Dharma wheel, which I think is on the 18th, and they're releasing the English translation for the first time of the long 100,000 line Prajnaparamita Sutra, which is a big thing. So they're asking a few different people to say something that they can use to engender excitement. Yeah. So they gave me two things. I can't decide which one to do, so I thought to do both, and then they can choose. Okay. So, yeah. So the assignment from 84,000 is the Prajnaparamita can appear as 100,000 lines or as a single syllable. Yeah. So the 100,000 line Prajnaparamita is the longest sutra in the whole Tibetan canon. Yeah. So it's big. So the what they asked is if you could offer just one word to someone encountering this text for the first time, what would that word be? So there's several different words I could give, but the first one that popped into my mind was persevere. And why did I say that? Because it's a huge sutra. The teaching in it are extremely profound. It's not so easy to understand. And so we need, you know, to give ourselves some space and time and create the causes to be able to understand it better. And so we need to persevere to do that. Yeah, but it's a wonderful sutra. Even though I haven't read it, my teachers all talk about it a lot. Okay, and the reason I haven't read it is because there hasn't been a good translation. So it's quite exciting to have a good one. The second question, yeah, that they asked was, yeah, that this is the longest sutra in the Buddhist canon, and for the first time on Chökyur Dzogchen, the anniversary of the turning of the Dharma wheel, the 84,000 will be publishing the English translation of this text. So if I had just one word to describe my feeling about the significant milestone, what would it be? Wow. Yeah. Why wow? Because translating this is a huge enterprise. Many people had to work on it. And it wasn't just the present group. There's people who have been translating things from Tibetan, you know, into English for a few decades. So whatever the present translators know and do is, you know, built upon what the past people did. So it's quite an exciting event. Okay. So that's what you can send to them. Okay, thank you. So we'll pay homage and generate bodhicitta like we usually do. Homage, when we pay homage, it means to take refuge in, to bow to, and to make offerings to. So in one word, you have to think of those three things. But, yeah. I just remember being younger and, you know, I didn't pay homage to much then. Yeah, and, you know, I found all the ceremony about God extremely boring, and so did my parents, so We very, very rarely went to anything. Yeah. Unless there was a lunch or food afterward, then, yeah, that was okay. So, so let's visualize the mirror field and ourselves surrounded by all sentient beings. And then, like Geshe-la mentioned yesterday, you know, he said this in terms of waking up each morning, but we can do this whenever we start any activity, which was, the purpose of my life is to benefit sentient beings. So that's cultivator motivation. Sometimes when we hear somebody ask us to think, you know, the purpose of my life is to benefit sentient beings, sometimes we go, uh-oh, what, me? Benefit sentient beings? I'm not a Buddha. I don't have any skills. I can't do this. I can't do that. And we just say, boo, you know, I'm nowhere near being a bodhisattva. What are they asking me to do? You know, it's helpful in these situations to see, first of all, what we're imputing on that one sentence. You know, the purpose of my life is to benefit sentient beings. We're not imputing that you have to be a Buddha today, or at least by tomorrow. We're talking about an attitude, and we're talking about even small things to do, but with a motivation of kindness. Yeah, turning off the lights, putting a new roll of toilet paper in the fixture when the old roll is out. You know, cleaning up after ourselves, taking the cat for a walk. There's so many small things that we can do that that are of benefit. So we have to, you know, do what we can with the living beings in front of us, and know that as we do that, gradually, quite naturally, our ability to be of greater and greater benefit will come. So what I'm saying is relax about the whole thing and enjoy benefiting sentient beings instead of getting into some crazy mental state that we often do about, I should be able to do this or that and I can't, or whatever it is. Okay? And so, with the attitude that wants to benefit sentient beings, then we're going to learn about the four establishments of mindfulness. Do you ever see your mind put up a lot of resistance to something? You have something like, you know, tomorrow is offering service Saturday. Oh, no. Instead, you know, it's like, well, you know, that doesn't mean we need to work until we're totally exhausted. Yeah. We offer service. We do what we can. And we enjoy it. And we'll be working with all of our friends who come here to help. Yeah. And so it's nice being with all these people who come and really want to help us and value the Abbey. And yeah, okay, it's hot outside. It could be hotter. Yeah. And there will be. Yeah, really, it could be. Yeah, you want to be, where are we now? July. Okay, how about being in India in June? Yeah, you want to be in Delhi in June, where it's so hot that you can fry a car, fry a car, fry an egg on the hood of a car. That's how hot it is. You bring your spatula and, cook your egg. Yeah, it's really hot. So, but we'll have lots of water and I'll have a good time. And I do want to really say that the community did a wonderful job during this last retreat. I mean, we had a lot of people here, and this room is, it's, did the air con get cooked? Yeah, you figured it out. Hooray. You benefited sentient beings. Hooray. Thank you. Because during the course, it was so hot, we had to shift into the other room. So all those things, to make the course happen, and cooking and vacuuming and, answering questions from people and everything. We did with an attitude of wanting to benefit each other and also all the people who came to enjoy the teachings. And I think people really enjoyed. I mean, what I heard was they really enjoyed and benefited a lot. Okay, so here we are. If the book is slightly at an angle, it's easier. So, multi-purpose Rheola suites. Well, anyway. Okay, so we were talking about last time mindfulness of the breath. And so I just want to go over that last bit of instruction, how to start. The one that I'm explaining here is one that seems to be quite popular, at least in some groups. Yeah, and there's so many different kinds of walking meditation. If you go into a Chinese temple, they'll have a special room for it with a Buddha statue in the center, and it's usually in a round, yeah. And then everybody walks around, and you walk quickly, because the idea is you've been sitting for a long time, so you need to get some exercise and get the blood flowing, and so everybody walks at their own pace, walking quickly like that. The Tibetans didn't have any kind of common walking meditation that they, taught to everybody at the beginning. I think basically because they got a lot of walking done just to stay alive in old Tibet. Yeah, because they didn't have vehicles with wheels, so you had to either carry something yourself or put it on the back of a yak. And and then you had to walk somewhere to get water and carry the water back. So, they had plenty of exercise, I think. So this one is the one my friends usually in the Achen Cha tradition, but some others teach this one. But like I said, there's many different walking meditations. Okay, so to begin walking meditation, be mindful of your right foot and your left foot stepping. Yeah, it doesn't matter which foot you start with, just one of them. Okay, don't jump. So you would walk, just like that. Walk to the end of where you're walking and then turn around, pause, and then walk back. And usually you do this slowly, yeah, to give you a chance to really, well, slow down and to be mindful of what's going on with you. Okay. So at first you just notice right, left, and what that feels like. What's really interesting is to notice how when you step with one foot, how your weight shifts. Yeah. And when you lift a foot up, yeah, the weight shifts this way. Then the other foot goes, it shifts this way. And you begin to see how your feet help each other. So if your feet were like different people, which they're not, but the attitude of people helping each other, yeah? That one is moving, the other one's his stable, and vice versa, okay? To make the mindfulness subtler, divide each step into three phases. So it's lifting, pushing your foot forward, and then placing it down. Okay, so then you would become aware of lifting, pushing, placing. Some people like to say the words to themselves. I don't think that's particularly important. Yeah. And then so you would lifting, pushing, placing, lifting, pushing, placing. Okay. Then you could slow it down even more and just, you know, the lift when you're foot is lifting, just very slowly lift it. Yeah. Feel how this foot is bearing the weight and taking the pressure, and slowly move it and slowly step down on it. Okay. So you would just do that. Yeah. So you can try, you know, starting at regular speed, then slow it down a little bit, and then slow it down even more. Okay. Lama Zopa, when he taught walking meditation, yeah, is he said, you just walk and you say, who is walking? Which is very interesting. Yeah. Who is walking? I am walking. Who? Who's the I that's walking? Huh? And who's the I deciding to move, to walk? Very interesting, yeah? Okay. So we're talking about the four postures now. So that was the one of walking. But then there's sitting, standing, and lying down, too, to be aware. Okay, so when sitting, standing, or lying down, use mindfulness to scan the body from the crown to the toes and up again, being aware of the momentary components of bodily functions and their arising and passing away. So some teachers teach doing a really slow body scan. Okay. Some usually starting here and going down. Some I think may start with your feet and going up. And just notice the sensations. Yeah. It can be very interesting doing that, and just slowly feeling each part of your body, and then finding out with surprise where there's tension, because you may think, oh, I don't have much tension, and then you start becoming aware, and even your foot is, you know, tense, and your leg, and your glutes, you know, and everything, yeah, you start watching. And so it's interesting just to do that slowly. And as you find tension in one or the other part of your body, then deliberately release it. Yeah. But that's interesting too, because some tension, it's easy to release. Some tension, it's like, well, I released it, but there's still some there, and I don't know how to get rid of the last remaining part. Yeah. So you just watch it, you know, it's don't judge. Yeah. Yeah. I think one of the problems we have in our meditation and also in our life in general is we judge everything. You know, and we judge ourselves, you know, is this right? Is this wrong? Did I do it right? Did I do it wrong? You know, oh, I'm a failure because I released some tension in my leg, but not all the tension. And all this judgmental kind of garbage, yeah, over simple tasks, you know, and reflecting again on what Geshe-la said yesterday about, you know, people being busy and getting things done. You know, and I shared at lunchtime, one of the things that I do that wastes a lot of time is ruminate, go through the same thing again, you know, which drives you crazy. But another thing that is really, when you look at it, is a big waste of time, is all the picayune criticism and all the judgment that we have. Now, I don't know if any of you have anybody here judgmental. Yeah, we have a little bit. You know, the smallest thing, that person's walking too fast, they're walking too slow, you know. They looked at me that way. Who do they think they are? They vacuum the floor, but there's still this speck of dirt over there. Oh, my goodness. You know, we could spend hours on that, you know. And for what purpose? You know, it's a guaranteed method to make ourselves miserable and to waste a lot of time, isn't it? Yeah, guaranteed. Not many things you can guarantee in life, but, you know, having a lot of judgment and a negative opinions, that's... That one, yeah, will make us miserable. Okay. So when this mindfulness, you know, of what's happening when you're sitting, standing, lying down, when it's combined with introspective awareness and analysis, leads to wisdom as explained in the next section of the sutra. So the part about just being aware, yeah, that's designed to help us slow down and start being mindful. But the real mindfulness for mindfulness practices is involved with wisdom. Okay, so looking at the impermanence, looking at the nature of dukkha, looking at the inability to find a self or essence. You know, all these kinds of things. That kind of analysis we should do. Yeah. Okay, mindfulness of the four thoughts. Oh, I thought it was her. Yeah. Yeah, I think she is. Yeah, somebody's in competition with you. Oh. Okay, let me try over again here. Mindfulness of the four postures brings awareness of body language, how we move through space, the way we greet others, the tone and volume of our voice. Just slowing down enough to be aware of each activity will calm the mind and stop the hurried and harried blurry in which many people live. As we become more habituated to observing our physical movements, they will become gentler, and how people react to us will change as well. Yeah, because body language is so important, you know, and we each have certain people that we know well, and we can read their body language. They don't have to say anything, but we know what's going on. And similarly, they can know what's going on with us according to our body language and according to our facial expressions. Yeah. When the Singaporeans were here, I had a group meeting just with them. All of you weren't there. And I don't think you came. And so some people started talking about the problem they had at work and at the boss and that. So I did my, you know how Sarah Bernhardt works, okay? And I, you know, hammed up the whole things. Oh, the excruciating pain of when you're
boss doesn't understand you, and, you know, and the grief you have when you have to quit your job, or you,
you know, I hammed it up, and like I usually do, and they had never seen me like that before. It was kind of funny, yeah. They were like, oh, yeah, I thought you were a nice subdued nun, you know. Yeah. But, you know, I ham it up because we're hammed up emotionally inside, and it comes out in our body language, yeah. Okay. Yeah, there's people who really do studies about body language, yeah, and about tone of voice. I think we all probably became expert at when we were kids, you know, when mom or dad had a certain tone of voice, we knew what they were going to say. Yeah, they didn't. You just heard the tone of voice and, uh-oh, okay. Or as they say, as soon as you heard your middle name, then you knew you were really in trouble. Somebody said the only reason they give kids middle names is so that they'll know when they're really in trouble. But that's true, isn't it? Yeah, I remember, you know, who do you think you are? You know, well, you just called my name. Yeah. Okay. So we become more habituated with, you know, being aware of our own physical movements and how we move through space. Yeah. And, you know, when we're behind somebody who's walking slower than us, or when we're walking slower and we can feel somebody's footsteps right behind us. Yeah. Yeah. How we react to loud noises. Yeah. Do we jump? Are we calm? You know, there's these things to learn about ourselves that way. You know, if you jump because of loud noises, it's understandable, you know, don't worry about it. That my Tibetan friends tell me that when they were having, I don't know if it was Indian independence or some kind of holiday, and they were firing a lot of firecrackers. And some of the kids got really afraid. And the parents thought, oh, they may have, in their previous life, escaped from Tibet and had the Chinese soldiers firing after them. And so the sound of the firecrackers is like that. You know, so there may be things like that that we discover about ourselves. Okay, but as we become more mindful, our movements become gentler. Yeah. And when you are able to move in a more gentle way, people respond to you differently. One of our friends, Bill Wilmot, you might remember, he came really tall guy, really tall, you know, and so he commented one time, he was a mediator, you know, but he commented one time that he didn't realize how much his being tall affected other people, because he would walk around a corner and maybe there was some shorter person, a woman coming this way, who would like jump because, oh, who's this big guy coming around the corner? You know, and he said, wow, I never realized that I could cause that. I'm sure he had done it before, but without realizing. And he said, I never realized that I could cause people who are shorter in height to jump when I came. He said, so that makes me slow down when I walk around a corner, you know, where somebody can't see me coming. So we pick up on stuff. Mindfulness brings awareness of interdependence, how our actions influence others and the environment, and how they in turn affect us. Okay. So lots of times people talk about picking up vibes from other people. You know vibes. Yeah, you remember vibes? Yeah, that word's been around for a long time. And you pick up vibes, you know. And it can affect you. And you can start, you know, thinking of all sorts of ideas, you know, when you have that vibe. But how our actions influence others and the environment and how they in turn affect us. So, you know, when we come into an environment and we're hurried around, that's affecting the people, you know. When we come into an environment and we're cheerful, that affects people. When we come into the environment and, you know, we're dragging our feet because we didn't sleep enough, that affects people. Yeah. So to become aware of these kinds of things. Okay. So mindfulness brings awareness of interdependence, how our actions influence others and the environment, and how they in turn influence us. And this is where our bodhicitta comes in, having a motivation to just even move through space in a way that makes people comfortable, to go into a room with a nice attitude and, you know, cheer people up. If we can, okay? So we become aware, are we tossing trash in the garbage can or on the roadside? Are we cutting in line or allowing others to go first? Are we spilling something and then saying somebody else will clean it up? Yeah, so this kind of awareness. And that's one of the benefits of having roommates, you know. It isn't just because we need the space, you know, that people go double or sometimes triple in a room. It's because that living with somebody else is how we learn about ourselves, you know. Because if we're doing something that they find disturbing, they'll let us know. And when they do that, we need to listen, because it could very well be something that we often do and we're totally unaware of it. Yeah. I mean, how many quirky habits do we have that we aren't even aware of, and then somebody points them out? Yeah. Okay. While this practice has a positive effect on our lives here and now, do not be satisfied just with that. Remember, the real purpose of mindfulness practice is liberation from samsara, and persevere so that your practice goes in that direction. This is done by observing the three characteristics: impermanence, dukkha, and no self. Or if you do it the four things that Geshe-la brought up, you know, impermanence, dukkha, unsatisfactoriness, emptiness, and selflessness. So emptiness was the act of a permanent partless, absence of a permanent partless independent person, and selflessness, the absence of a truly existent person. But you can be aware of those characteristics when we're doing different actions. With mindfulness, dissect each activity into small physical elements or gestures and into tiny moments of action. Then use wisdom to investigate if there is a self in any of these components. Yeah. So I'm turning my head to look at one side of the room or the other. Yeah, is there a self that's turning the head? How does my head get turned? Well, you'd say, oh, the nerves are firing and telling something to the muscles, but what's generating that intention? Yeah, the nerves and muscles aren't having that intention. So what's generating it and who? So very interesting. examine each situation carefully to avoid grasping, I go, or this action is produced by me, you know? Okay. Instead, observe each component of the action of going from the intention to the movement to the completion of the movement. Because it's kind of an abbreviation to say, I'm going. Yeah. But because there's all sorts of steps in going. Yeah. There's the intention. There's knowing where you're going. Yeah. There's starting to move, deciding what speed you're walking or going in, you know. Yeah, getting there, watching the sensations as you are, making sure you don't step on any bugs or bump into a wall or who knows what, yeah. Okay, and so observe those, all the components of an action. And then you say, okay, what is the action? Yeah. I say, I'm walking. What is walking? How do I know I'm walking? And who is walking? Yeah, when we say I'm walking, what is walking? Is it just moving the feet or covering a certain distance or moving in a certain speed? Do we have to use our legs to walk? You know, is crawling a form of walking? There's like, yeah. Because it's very interesting, really examining what we mean by certain words. And this is not a language lesson. It's not an English lesson. It's a lesson in discerning what is a conventional truth and what is the ultimate truth? Yeah, because we say, I'm walking. Everybody understands what you mean. Yeah, but then when you start to investigate, yeah, what is the action of walking? Yeah, and how do we know we're walking? I find this one, that question, very helpful to ask. When I feel tired, I say, how do I know I'm tired? I'm like, okay, what are the sensations in my body that if I have those and for a certain period of time, then I say, I'm tired. Yeah, where do you feel tiredness? In your stomach, in your back? Where do you feel it? Yeah. Yeah, I feel it in my eyelids. Yeah. But then there's a feeling in the rest of my body too of heaviness. So, you know, to really say, oh, I use certain words, but what is the basis of me saying that? And what do I really mean by that? Yeah. Because as we've constantly discover by living with other people, communicating is not something we should take for granted. It's not always so easy. Yeah. Because we mean one thing by a word, somebody else means another. We use one tone of voice, but somebody interprets it to mean something else. It's, yeah. Okay, examine each situation carefully to avoid grasping I go or the action is produced by me. Observe each component of the action of going from the intention to the movement, to the completion of the movement. Understand I am walking to be nothing more than the activities of the physical elements. It's just what the atoms and molecules are doing. There is no independent person instigating walking or doing the walking. That reminds me, you know, when the nuns from Dharma Drum were visiting, and they taught us one of the koans that they use. Who is dragging this corpse around? That is a great koan, yeah. And it fits very well with mindfulness of the body, because one aspect of mindfulness of the body is it will become a corpse, yeah. You know, who is lugging this corpse around? While a self-existent, continuous entity appears to be moving in an uninterrupted fashion, it is nothing but a series of mental and physical phenomena arising and passing away. That's all walking is. A series of mental and physical phenomena, because there's an intention, yeah, which is mental, and the sensations that we're feeling, that's our mind that's feeling them. But the walking is just the physical phenomena arising, passing away. The mental part arising, passing away. Yeah, so there's a continuity of our body. There's a continuity of our consciousness, yeah. But you can't find a body in all those parts, and you can't find a consciousness in all of its mind moments. And we can't find a person in any of it. But telling yourself the conclusion doesn't bring the same kind of benefit as if we really stand there or sit there and go, okay, you know, who is doing this? Yeah. Whose stomach hurts? Yeah. Or what stomach hurts? How do you know where is your stomach ache? Is it on this side? Is it on this side? Where, you know, when you have a stomach ache, where is it? Yeah. So, just to see that there's one moment after the other, and they're all different moments. Each one of them is arising and passing away. When we can notice arising and passing away very well, then we don't get so reactive to everything that's happening, because we realize in the next moment it's gone. Yeah, and okay, the continuity may last for a while, but each moment of the continuity is changing, and eventually the continuity of many things stops. You know, it's like, you know, when we were building the Buddha Hall, sometimes I would think, yeah, the Buddha Hall is falling apart. Yeah, because we're in the process of building it, but already it's falling apart. Yeah? Because falling apart is disintegrating. And as time goes on, everything is disintegrating. Yeah. So just I would do that just to remind myself, okay, we're building, but it's already falling apart. And one day it will go kerplunk, you know? And it will fall apart, and we don't know when that's going to happen. Yeah. Hopefully when we're not under a pillar, okay, or under the roof. But, you know, someday. Yeah. So that can be a good kind of thing to remember. When you get something new, yeah, this is already broken. Yeah, it's not broken at that moment, but it will break sometime. show. If I say it's already broken, then I'm not going to cling to it. Mm-hmm. And the same thing with relationships with people, you know. We are already separating because anything that comes together has to separate. Yeah. So it's good just to remind ourselves of that. Yeah, this is already separating. So often we don't see the subtle impermanence, and so we think that something isn't really changing. Yeah. But as the example His Holiness gives is, you know, we don't notice the sun moving throughout the day every little bit. We have the hiccups. But we know it rises, and we know it rises in the east and the east, and it sets in the west. So it had to go from, you know, east to west. And it did it moment by moment by moment in such small increments that we couldn't notice it. But that's the subtle impermanence. And then the sun setting is the coarse impermanence. Yeah. I was once walking in Kathmandu and walking, and then there was a building at the end of the street. And we were walking, and then all of a sudden, the building went. Yeah, it was really weird. Yeah. Usually you think of things falling apart gradually, but, you know, they can fall apart suddenly. Mm-hmm. And we say fall apart because they're changing from what they were, and we wanted them to remain what they were. If we want them to change, then when the change happens, we don't say falling apart. We say, oh, they're coming, something's coming into being, because we're focusing on something new happening, which is what we want. Okay. So while a self-existent, continuous entity appears to be moving in an uninterrupted fashion, it is nothing but a series of mental and physical phenomena arising and passing away. Having come into being, they break up right on the spot. Okay? So we usually think arising, abiding, ceasing, you know? So they're growing, then they stay the same for a while, then they cease. Yeah? Well, here it's quite interesting. The way what those three words mean can be changed. Well, yeah, something arises when something new comes into being. Yeah. At that time also, it's abiding because it's different from what was there before. And it's also ceasing because it's changing into something else. So that arising, abiding, and ceasing all occur at the same time. Sit with that one and see if you don't go nutty. But, you know, you can understand it. Something's arising. Yeah. Something new is coming into being. Yeah. But what's coming into being is not, you know, what was there before. So something is abiding. And then it's changing some more, so it's also ceasing. Yeah, good to remember, because then when things cease, we don't get so upset. Yeah. Okay. The greater the mindfulness and introspective awareness during daily life activities, the stronger they will be during meditation sessions. So what we do in the break time is important. Hmm. Several practical benefits accrue as well. Aware of the needs of the body, we will eat the right amount without overeating or depriving ourselves of nourishment. So when you have awareness of your body, yeah, you eat the right amount. Not too much, not too little. Yeah. Accidents caused by careless movements are prevented when you have mindfulness. Yeah. Mindful of speech, we avoid harsh words and other verbal non-virtues. Mindfulness when listening reduces instances of misinterpreting others' words and jumping to conclusions. I'm going to read that one again, okay, because it really solves some problems we have. Mindful of speech, we avoid harsh words and other non-virtues. Okay. Mindful when listening, yeah, really listening. What are they saying? Trying to understand it. Reduces instances of misinterpreting others' words and jumping. And when we misinterpret their words, we jump to conclusions. Anybody here jump to conclusions? Yeah. How to create a mess without even trying. While effort is necessary when establishing mindfulness, avoid making the mind tight. This is really important, you know. And I keep remembering that little girl in the, was it Waldorf? What's the?
Montessori.
What?
Montessori.
Montessori, thank you. Montessori preschool that I went to visit in Mexico when, you know, I said, let's meditate, and sat down, a cute little girl, and she sat down and she went, okay. You know, watch when, you know, your brow tightens. Some people I've noticed when we're chanting, their brow tightens. Yeah. Interesting. Why? Yeah. And so, yeah, just being aware of these things and what it tells us about ourselves. Mm-hmm. Okay, accidents caused by careless movements are prevented. And mindful of speech, we avoid harsh words and other verbal non-virtues. Mindfulness when listening reduces instances of misinterpreting others' words and jumping to conclusions. Same with reading things. I think lots of times people don't read the emails very well. I know I don't, you know, because I'll read something quickly and then I'll go back and read it and I'll say, oh, that, you know, did they change the words at the time it was already sent? You know, no, it's just what I'm reading, I'm understanding differently. But sometimes, yeah, we write emails to people and you get an answer that is, you know, well, you don't know where it's coming from. And needless to say, they probably have that reaction when they read our emails. Okay, well, effort is necessary when establishing mindfulness. Avoid making the mind tight. Keep mindfulness on the object in a soft and gentle way. Okay, okay. Simply train the mind continuously. As mindfulness deepens and becomes more continuous, it naturally becomes aware of and sensitive to subtler mental and physical occurrences. We cannot force ourselves to be aware of subtle objects, such as the momentary intentions and the physical elements involved in walking. Nevertheless, in practicing walking meditation over a long period of time, you will come to observe mental and physical processes on a subtle level. Yeah, so we can't force that. But if we just do the practice automatically, the mindfulness gets subtler. Okay? You will come to observe mental and physical processes on very subtle levels. For example, experiencing each intention and movement in micro detail and observing them in micro moments as they arise and pass away. Yeah. Arising and passing away, very good to practice when you're having a colonoscopy. Okay. Because, yeah, especially, I mean, if you've taken some anesthesia, then you know, it's, you're kind of out of it when you do. But if you don't take anesthesia, then you feel that thing going up. And it's like you feel every little bit, yeah? And it's like, oh, I didn't know that my colon and my intestines were so sensitive. And, you know, and you're, yeah. So really, you're not experiencing each intention. The doctor's the one that has the intention. And the movement in micro detail and observing them in micro moments as they arise and pass away. You know, so they put it up slowly, slowly. Yeah. But when they, you know, you can feel it. When it's done, they take it out bigger bits at a time, you know, because they're still looking when they take the, what do you call the thing they shove up you, the tube? What? A scope?
Colonoscopy scope.
A colonoscopy scope. Okay. Yeah. So, you know, you feel it go up, you feel it come down. Yeah. And then when they finally pull it out, you go. But sometimes, because I don't get sedated, you know. So they come to a point where there's a curve, you know, because our intestines curve. And it's like the colonoscopy scope, you know, is not, it doesn't necessarily follow the intestine, the curve so well. And, you know, when the doctor says, okay, hold on, you know, are you sure you don't want anything? Yes, I'm sure I don't want anything. And then he goes, and you're going, oh, impermanence, impermanence. Yes. And then in 2 seconds, somehow he's gotten it around the curve in your intestine. Yeah. But yeah, you become more aware of the subtle movements when it's something like that. Yeah, a benefit of practicing Dharma during your colonoscopy. I mean, it's better than sitting there going, or you lie there going, you know, when is this over? I don't like it. You know, no, use your practice. Okay, oh, now here's a really good one. Mindfulness of the foulness of the body. This is the next section. So this is another way of mindfulness of the body. Meditation on the parts of the body is found in all Buddhist traditions and in medical school. And it, except they don't meditate, they just, yeah. And it has many purposes. By observing the body in a straightforward manner, we know the body for what it is on the conventional level. And we realize it is not worthy of attachment. And I really wish, you know, do you think there's any way we could get permission to go to something? Yeah. When they, after someone dies, when they...
Yeah, when they do the autopsy. Well, we'd have to know a physician that would help us get in, or... a pathologist that does them. Mm-hmm. I guess we could ask some of our doctor friends to see if they know anybody.
Yeah. Yeah. And then usually you would probably have to ask the family of the person. Mm-hmm. Or maybe not.
No, I mean, when students go in, they don't
ask. You know, they don't tell.
Okay. Just, yeah. So you can tell them we're students.
Yeah. Well, we will. Yeah. We would be.
Yeah. We're Buddhist students.
Or we'd be passed out people. I don't know.
Yeah.
Oh, is he? Oh.
What?
The funeral director in Newport. He does autopsies there?
Who?
Someone we know? I don't think so. Pathologists do that.
Okay. Well, you guys can take that offline afterwards. Okay. Okay. But you do see, you know, some of you I've sent the pictures around from the autopsies I've gone to. You know, you can see that it really, yeah, lets you know that this body is not worthy of attachment. Yeah. And it's very useful for practicing Dharma, so we have to take care of it. Okay, two things, you know, that are simultaneous on the body. But see, it is not worthy of attachment, lessens our attachment to the body, which eases mental and physical tension. A lot of our tension is because we're attached to the body. You know, there's some feeling that doesn't feel normal, and instantly, you know, we tense up, you know, or instantly our mind gets afraid, you know, oh, I know I have cancer. Yeah, what happened, you know, nothing. But you know, to watch how attached we are to the body and sensitive to small things, you know. I was walking with Venerable Munlam not long ago, and we were in the forest going through a patch with a lot of mosquitoes. And the mosquitoes had really sharp, what do you call them, needles? What? Huh? Proboscis?
Proboscis. Proboscis. It's the thing that they used to draw the blood in.
Yeah, well, any really sharp stingers. You know, they aren't really stingers. They're not needles. They're proboscis. Okay, yeah. They're that word that starts with a P and ends with an S. Okay, plums. Okay. Yeah. But, yeah, so we were walking and I was, you know, shooing going like this to get them away. And I looked over at her, and she's just standing there. And there's one mosquito, you know, having lunch on, you know. And I said, And she said, yeah, you know, I'm practicing generosity with my body. Yeah. But, you know, when you sit there and just, I was thinking, oh, yeah, I felt the
proboscis.
They got to think of a better word. They got to the proboscis go in, and instantly the feeling of, no, you know, no, that hurts. You know, I've got to do something. It hurts the body. And then watching her not do that made me think, okay, I need to slow down a little bit. Because, you know, every small thing, you react. Yeah. But it wasn't a small thing. It was a big proboscis. Yeah, like this big. Going into it. Okay, so this mindfulness of the body, yeah, lessens our attachment to it, which eases mental and physical tension. It also sparks the aspiration for liberation. You want to be liberated from this kind of body. The mindfulness practice can lead to serenity, and when insight is applied, it can lead to nirvana. Okay. Principal way attachment to the body arises is, guess what? huh? Sex. You guessed right. It was either going to be sex or food, huh? Probably sex. Yeah. So a principal way attachment to the body arises is sexual lust, which is based on distorted attention viewing the body as clean and attractive. And that's true, isn't it? If you look at, you know, what is the nature of this body that's turning me on, it's like blood and guts. That's it. Yeah. Mindfulness of the parts of the body counteracts this. However, this meditation does not imply that the body is evil or sinful. So you take that kind of ridiculous judgment away. Yeah. Rather, closely observing this object of intense attachment releases undue obsession with our own and others' bodies, and in this way enables us to have a healthier relationship with our body. Yeah. You can start just by watching how you react when you see a dead animal or a dead insect. Yeah. I was walking with somebody in, where was it? Putosan, maybe, in China, and with another nun, and, oh, she wasn't a nun at that time, with a laywoman. And there was a dead rat in front of us, yeah. And it had gotten run over or something. It looked kind of gruesome. But she was walking and she saw it, and her reaction was, ah! You know? And you know, I fortunately didn't do that. I, you know. But yeah, how it's interesting because when we see the body like that for what it is, doesn't matter a rat's body or a human body, they're all the same kind of thing. Then you see how the instant reaction is, ooh. And then you have to say, then why do I want to hug it and kiss it and everything like that? It's really not so great. Yeah. Okay. We may think that mindfulness of parts of the body will make our mind agitated. In fact, many people experience that the mind becomes more peaceful and concentrated when contemplating what really is the body. And that was what happened to me when I was doing more intense. And when you've done, some of you have done the meditation on this, yeah. When you really kind of just go over the body, every bit of it, and like what's in there, yeah, your mind settles down. At least my mind did. It didn't make me agitated. It was like, okay, this is it. Nothing to go, yay, this is gorgeous, but also something to respect because it's the basis of our precious human life. Okay. So in fact, many people experience that the mind becomes more peaceful and concentrated when contemplating what really is the body, which allows deeper understanding and the wisdom of impermanence, dukkha, and no self to arise. Because you watch, you know, maybe you think about, you know, your intestines and what they look like when they're young and how they work when they're young. And have they always been like that? I mean, once you were a baby with itty bitty intestines, yeah, they didn't always act like that. And when you get old, they're going to be, I don't know, do they get stretched out by long use? Or,
Well, you mine, know, what happens?
Mine certainly did.
So the ear colonoscopy takes 2 days?
I don't know.
You don't know?
These are mysteries. I don't know.
Really?
Oh. I don't know. Well, they change, but
yeah,
I don't know. The worst thing is they start growing things that shouldn't be there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do all of them start growing things?
Well, I don't know. One doctor once said that if we lived long enough, we would all have things growing places they're not supposed to grow.
I know with our face that happens. Yeah, when you go to have your skin checked every year, the place where I go, she calls them barnacles. Yeah. And every year, so now I go in and I say, I have some new barnacles I want you to look at, because that's really kind of what they are, you know. You have spots. Yeah, spots are one thing. Then you have little things, the bumps and moles and things you have no idea what they are, and something that ends with keratosis. We're really long. What are you doing?
What is it? Keratosis.
Keratosis. Okay. But there's different keratoses. Yeah.
It's complicated.
Yeah. And what do they look like? And then they change. You know, I've had one on my leg, and, you know, it was one shape for a while. Now it's another shape, and, you know, a nicer shape before it was, you know, now it's a more circular. Yeah. Yeah, I don't show any of you, though. yeah. But, yeah, so you get all these kinds of things, yeah? And there's no way around it. Yeah, I remember when I was younger, of course, I was younger a minute ago, too, but when I was way younger, you know... Rinpoche said that if you could, like today, look in your mirror, look in the mirror and see what you would look like when you were, you know, 70 or 80, you would probably fall over. Yeah. And yeah, but then you age slowly. Yeah. And then one day it dawns on you and you fall over then. Yeah. Because, you know, it's like there was a lot of time was going by, but I didn't feel like I was getting older, you know? And then something happened. I don't know what. Yeah. Oh, I think it's when, because what is it, the stuff under your cheeks?
Collagen.
A collagen, yeah. At a certain age, as you age, the collagen goes bye-bye. I don't know where it goes, but it disappears.
Saggy.
It gets what?
It gets,
it gets sagged.
It gets saggy. It falls with gravity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it, yeah, so it sags or it disappears too. But whatever it is, it's your cheeks aren't puffy like they used to be. They're, you know, more like mine, you know? Yeah. And your fingernails start cracking and breaking. Yeah, and your toenails, you need a sledgehammer. Yeah. Just you wait.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and then you can't bend over to get to your toes. So somebody else has to work the sledgehammer to cut your toenails. And, you know, it's very interesting.
And your arms become your grandmother's arms.
Oh, yeah. Your skin is like, what happened? Yeah. You know? Yeah. And it just happened overnight. You're sure. You're sure, yeah? Like... You know, yesterday my skin was okay, and today it looks like Bubby's skin. What in the world did that happen? You know? Yeah? Yeah?
When I lived in Australia, there was this exhibit that came to Brisbane, And I don't remember the name of it, something like The Amazing Body. And I think that we've had a smaller version here in Spokane at one time where the body is plasticized, or different organ, different systems of the body are plasticized. What was so fascinating was to see dissections of the body, first horizontal, and then just literally like every 2 inches, seeing, and you were able to see, they were like hanging so that you could, like looking through a dress shop, you know, and looking through different dresses. It's kind of like that. You could see the different parts of the body and what the organs or the lumens looked like. And then it was horizontal, went through the body horizontally.
Yeah.
And then there was one exhibit that was just the skin. Just the skin. It's fascinating to see just the skin or just the circulatory system. Yeah, it was, it really, it had a very lasting effect on me for a few weeks after that.
I got to see that at one point too. Very interesting, especially with the nerves, when they, a whole thing, that just had your nerves. And so there's a lot going on. Okay. So this practice changes us, because what we used to see in an incorrect manner, we now seeing what is in fact foul as beautiful. We're seeing it incorrectly. So what we used to see in an incorrect manner, we now know as it actually is. What we used to hold as stable and permanent, we now know is constantly arising and ceasing. What we used to see as beautiful is in fact foul. And that one of just seeing the skin, it's like, okay. Previously, we saw the five aggregates as the self, or as a desirable possession for the self. Now we see, now we clearly see they are not. And this brings a sense of joy and bliss. The sharpness and clarity of the mind can last for days, and it is blissful. Once we experience this type of joy, the seeming pleasure arising from sensual objects becomes uninteresting and pointless. So just this awareness here of the foulness of the body, and when you can do it really well, it brings a sense of joy, which is interesting because you would think it would bring a sense of, which it does, but there's also a certain feeling of joy. It's like, oh, now I understand what it is. Buddhaghosa explains mindfulness of the parts of the body in the Visuddhimagga, 8th chapter. The meditation session may begin with mindfulness of breathing to calm the mind, and then continue with mindfulness of the various parts of the body. This can be our own body, called contemplating the body internally, or we can contemplate the bodies of others, which is contemplating the body externally. The Buddha mentioned 32 parts of the body to be mindful of. In this practice, we become aware of each part one by one, observing and investigating its characteristics. The 32 parts of the body are broken up into 6 groups. So who was here when we started doing this many years ago? Two people. So we sat around anatomy book, right? And we looked at everything and how it looks, and as you go through these different groups. So there's six things. There's the skin pentad, there's 5 things in this, the kidney pentad, the lungs pentad, the brain pentad, the fat hexad and the urine hexad. Okay, and there's a little chant that goes with it. Okay, head, hair, body, hair, nail, teeth, skin, muscles, tendons, bones, marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, connective tissue, spleen, lungs, intestines, mesentery, gorge, feces, brain. That sounds great. Feces next to the brain. Okay. Bile, phlegm, blood, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, grease, spit, snot, oil, and urine. Beautiful things. We just say the name and you have a visual image, yeah? And so in the Theravada countries, you learn this by heart, you know, and this is how you meditate. You go through these going, well, this will describe it, but you go each one and then backwards and then you'll see. But you learn it really well, yeah? Begin by focusing mindfulness on the skin pentad, which is hair, head hair, body hair, nails, teeth, skin. When you put them together to a face, that's nice. But head hair, yeah, body hair, yeah, your nails out there. Even they, you know, they do them up. You have a manicure and you paint them purple with pink flowers on them or whatever they do nowadays. You know, nails, teeth. Yeah, sitting out there. And then skin in a big kind of lump. Okay. So begin by focusing mindfulness on the skin pentad, which consists of the physical features we see when looking at the person. Place mindfulness on each part one by one, observing its color, shape, texture, location in the body, and surrounding tissue. What is the hair on my head? Okay, is it all one color? What's the color? What's the texture of your hair? Can you feel, you can't feel it that way, but there's some feeling this way. Okay, how about the hair, if you have hair on your body, you know, what does that feel? That's coarser. Color, shape, texture, location in the body and surrounding tissue, you know. Do you have a hair growing out of a mole? Yeah, many people have that. Yeah, and hair, yeah, the hair's in your nose. Yeah, who knew? Yeah, my dad knew. He had a special scissors for cutting them, you know? Yeah, you usually don't think about that, do you? Or how about your eyelashes? Yeah, or is there hair in your ear? Little teeny hairs or something? On the outer ear? What? What? Oh, they have hair growing out of their ears? Oh, my mom told us we would have potatoes because our ears were so dirty. So some people have ears. I guess you can have hair or potatoes. Yeah, I need to add that to the book of, you know, words of my precious mother. Okay, so place mindfulness on each part one by one, observing its color, shape, texture, location in the body, and surrounding tissue. Yeah, so we see here, this is what Geshe-la also went through. This weekend, on many things, he was saying, you know, what is it? What's its characteristics? What are its divisions? You know, what are its advantages, its disadvantages? What happens if you don't do it? What happens? You know, all these kinds of things. And he said, really examine, especially our afflictions, using that kind of schema. And then you really get to study your afflictions. It's like, what makes it arise? And, you know, how many divisions of anger are there? How many kinds of attachment are there? And, you know, what's the characteristic of attachment? What's the characteristic of anger? What does my body feel like when I have attachment? What does it feel like when I'm angry? You know? And where? You know, when I'm angry, like, okay, where? I have sensations in my body, but where? Yeah. When there's a pleasant feeling, where? Okay. What is the hair on my head? Oh, it's this precious stuff that is attached to people seeing me as attractive or not. Yeah, well, it's no longer there. Is it attractive in and of itself? What is the hair on my head made of? When I think of my hair separate from the rest of the body, does it appear attractive to me? Yeah, not when it's mixed in the salad. Not when you put it on the altar. Not when it's clogging a drain.
Someone else's hair is in the sink after they've shaved.
Yeah. Yeah. Somebody who's waiting for you to clean the sink. Yeah, after they've shaved. Yeah. It's best to throw that water outside. Yeah. Unless you like pumping your drains. Yeah. Okay. Mindfully observe each component of the skin pentad in this way, saying its name and contemplating it. After contemplating the head hair, yeah, then do the body hair. Then do the nails. Yeah, then the teeth, then the skin. Oh, that's another interesting thing as you age. Yeah, your bone recedes, and so your gums recede. So then you have more spaces between your teeth. And so that makes eating couscous and... And what?
Quinoa.
Yeah. It makes those two really interesting. Yeah. You can open a store afterwards with quinoa in every corner of your mouth. Yeah.
It's another meal.
Yeah. So you could say, oh, I don't eat in the afternoon, but actually you're studying, you're keeping food in your mouth the rest of the day. Yeah. Yeah, that happens, doesn't it? Yeah. And then sometimes you have to have a tooth pulled. Yeah. That's fun. Yeah. Oh, you don't look too happy. No, it's great. Yeah, because my dad was a dentist, so, you know, the orthodontist was a family friend. The oral surgeon was a family friend. So I remember one time the oral surgeon was working. I had a polyp on my tongue or something, you know. So I'm sitting there in the dental chair like that. And, you know, and my dad and the oral surgeon are friends. So my dad's in there, you know, and Dad and Jerry, and, you know, they're sitting and talking. And I'm like, oh, look at that. Look at where it's rooted in the tongue. Look at this. Look at that. And it's like, yeah. But also I was surrounded by love. I mean, you know, people who cared for me. So, yeah, but it's things that you don't think of, yeah, and then all of a sudden you wake up and it's you, yeah. Yeah, I've noticed my eyebrows are beginning to look more like Geshe Zopa's. Yeah, not in terms of how full they are, but how they're getting shorter here, You know, my eyebrows used to be so much longer, and now they're shortening. Yeah. 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 She's always had that. Yeah. So yeah, so you start to notice these things. Yeah. Okay. So you mindfully observe each component of the skin pentad in this way, saying its name and contemplating it. After contemplating the head hair, then the body hair, nails, teeth, and skin, then you proceed backwards, contemplating each one again until you reach the head hair. So you go head hair, body hair, nail, teeth, skin, skin, teeth, nail, body hair, head hair. So you go forward, you go backwards, contemplating each one. Then you go forward again, contemplating each element of the skin pentad again, and continuing on to the kidney pentad. Okay, so muscles, tendons, bones, marrow, and kidneys. Why all of the first four are with kidneys, I don't know. Yeah, does that make any medical sense at all? I mean, muscles, tendons, bones, marrow, yeah. Kidneys? Anyway, okay. So you go forward with the skin one, backwards with the skin one, forward with the skin one again, and then you do forward the kidney one. Yeah. Yeah, the kidney pentad. And then you go backwards in the kidney pentad. So you would go kidneys, marrow, bones, tendons, muscles, and then back further again. Yeah, it was just skin. Yeah, skin, teeth, nails, body hair, head hair. And then you go forward again, doing the skin pentad and the kidney pentad, and then you go to the third one, which is the lungs pentad. Okay? And then you go back and forth like that, you know? Then contemplate, when you get to the kidney pentad, then contemplate those in reverse, going back to head hair and, you know, that pentad. Then you go forward again to the kidneys, followed by the lung pentad. Some teachers say that instead of going back to the head hair each time, it's fine to go back to the initial member of that pentad or hexad. In this way, become familiar with all aspects of each body part. Okay. Yeah.
I'm curious how much time you spend with each one, because one place I've struggled with in this meditation is like, you know, if I'm spending a few minutes on each of these five things in the skin pentad, going forward and then going backward and then going forward, plus I'm, you know, half asleep and distracted, like there's maybe one pentad, you know, per session, but like to move forward, but to the different sections and
yeah,
like how does that go?
They could go forward and backward all the way back to the beginning, or you could go forward and backward just to the of that one pentad, you know. So you can do it that way. How much time you spend on each? I do just as, you know. Sometimes one of them really gets me, and I spend a lot of time on that, and another one maybe not quite so much. Yeah. And also, I think when you go through it first, you go through it more slowly. And then after that, you do more, probably more quickly. Although if there's sometimes something grabs you, you know, and it's like, oh, I want to focus on that one more. Yeah. You say lungs. Well, what do the lungs really look like? Yeah. What do they look like? We need
like
to-
what? Upside down tree. Oh, the inside. But on the outside, they're just, they're ugly. I don't know what to tell you. Yeah. But, you know, in school, when there was a big thing about people quitting to smoke, in science class, they had lungs rigged up to air or something, and they would blow them up. But they did that with healthy lungs and then with lungs, people that had smoked for a bazillion years, and they were black. You know, with all the tar. So it was very gross.
Yeah. But, you know, I wonder, are they called areoles or something?
All the little
parts of a lung.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many little things, and you have the bronchial tubes and different tubes and the little pouches in there. Yeah. And think that that's going on all day, then we're hardly ever aware of it.
Yeah. And the oxygen is being absorbed in all those little pockets.
Yeah.
Yeah, and going to the bloodstream then.
Yeah. So, okay. Questions, comments?
I was trying to look to see if I could get my hands on it. We had charts with the different colors of the body parts and the shapes. And, you know, we spent time in small groups going through these and exploring them in a really... really vivid way. It was cool.
Yeah.
Very
beneficial.
Doing
it in those small groups was really helpful.
Yeah. 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 I'll look for the chart. I know we had them.
Okay.
And Venerable Punso put together a booklet the last time we did this as a winter retreat that was very helpful.
Oh, where is it?
It's in the library.
Ah.
A digital copy. I'll send it around to everyone.
Yeah. Or maybe put it out on display in the library. People can look. And we have that big anatomy book.
In Asia, you don't have to go to an autopsy. You just need to go to a wet market.
Because,
you know, Chinese, we eat everything. I've seen intestines and we've eaten it. And lungs and brains, it's eaten.
Yeah.
So it's not something... weird for us.
But yeah, it's not weird because you're eating it and it's other people's bodies you're eating.
Yes.
But when you think of your own body being cut up like that and hanging from hooks, then you see attachment arising. Yeah, but just seeing this stuff, when you've worked in a kitchen, you know what it looks like. It's, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Someone online is wondering, how do we maintain mindfulness of the body when working at the computer intently?
Well, at that point, your mindfulness is... on what you're thinking about and what you're writing or what you're reading, okay? So at that point, your mindfulness isn't going to be on your body all the time. You could check in with your body periodically and just say kind of what's going on. But, you know, mindfulness is on one thing at a time. Mm-hmm.
So I know we talk a lot about the body decaying when dying, but I wish you guys could have this experience. It's interesting to see what the body kind of not taken care of or tended to well can do when you're alive. Like a lot of the people in Seattle kind of have fentanyl issues, and apparently that leads to necrosis. I've watched a man cut his skin off with a knife, but just the smell of walking around him with rotted flesh, like the smell is so strong, it's like the sky rejects it. It's like, I don't want this either. This guy had his legs wrapped in a sleeping bag and was spraying it with Lysol, and it was still so pungent, I had to walk away.
Wow. Was it infected? I mean, does he go to a doctor?
Gangrene. It's just, you'll see a lot of amputees. I can't remember what it is about fentanyl that causes a lot of the muscles and skin to die and, not being able to attend to their body through bathing and things like that. But I was just amazed to see what the body can do or what can become of it. Even a person who's alive and breathing,
yeah,
just unable to really tend the body. But just, I was like, oh my God, it's just overwhelming. Like it's a scent, when you smell it, you know it, and you will never confuse it with anything else.
Yeah. People, soldiers probably experience that.
Many years ago, I attended a retreat with Shetsang Rinpoche, and it was actually many years ago. I attended a retreat with Shetsang Rinpoche, and it was related to Tantra practice. But what was really interesting is that he had us practicing the Satipatthana Sutra and went into great detail, like the start of it, how you started with the walking meditation and the breathing. He really did that. He emphasized on that, and that led me, when Geshe-la these past days talked about, you know, you start from the beginning and you have to always come back. Mm-hmm. And so you are unable to practice the Tantra, because when you're thinking about all the shanas and chakras and, I don't know, the troughs, and, you know, and you are not able to really let go of that attachment, then you may be too distracted to even hold for a second mm-hmm. any of those higher practices. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. It was very skilled. I found it very good. Yeah.
Developed gradually. And I think mindfulness of the body we have is really important, you know, especially before you do Tantra practice, so that you, you know, because you're visualizing having a different body. And if you don't know what your body is to start with, then it can get kind of confusing. Anything else? Okay. We'll close then.